10 years that I've been a pastor,
what I'm going to talk to you about the next 3 weeks has probably been the single biggest area that I've counseled people on, dealing with feelings of shame, guilt, unworthiness, insignificance, feelings of uselessness. This has probably been the biggest area of struggle that I think most people deal with. And I believe probably here this morning that most of us are very, very, very familiar with shame and what shame feels like to varying degrees. Some of us, it may be a daily experience in our life. So for some of the rest of you, it may be a weekly experience. For others, it may be once a month. For others of you, it may just be something that's just dull. It's there. You try not to pay attention to it. But unless we find a way to deal with shame in our lives, it's a debilitating emotion. It robs us, it poisons us, and it keeps us from ever experiencing the life that God intended for every man and woman and child to experience. It just robs us of joy. Many people, you know how they try to deal with shame? They try to pretend that there's nothing to be ashamed of, for example. And they just try to pretend that it's gone in their life, that it's disappeared, that it's non-existent. But for many other people, they can't pretend, and they spend their lives cowering, struggling, never feeling quite adequate for everything, never having the confidence in life that God meant for them to have. You know how shame tends to make most people feel? And this, again, has been my experience dealing with people. It tends to make them feel like quitting and giving up. It makes us very discouraged. When things keep getting thrown back in our face, when we keep feeling like we're a failure in life, and that tends to be what shame does. It just makes us feel like, I just don't want to go on anymore. I just don't want to face life. So I want to talk to you about that for the next 3 weeks, because I believe that the Bible gives a very practical and very, very helpful way for overcoming shame. I also want you to know this. There are many books that have been written on this topic. I mean, you can go to Barnes & Noble, you can go to B. Dalton, you can go to Northwestern Bookstore, whether it's a Christian bookstore or secular bookstore, and you'll find an awful lot written on this topic. What I'd like to ask you to do for the next 3 weeks is simply ponder and consider the perspective that you hear. Because I believe that the Bible gives one of the greatest and best kept secrets of how to overcome the issue of shame in our life and how to deal with it. I also just want you to know it's been probably the most impactful thing in my life, in my own experience, my own Christian experience, my own religious experience, has been primarily around this issue and what God has helped me, had to help me with. And you'll understand that as the morning and the week goes on, and I share with you a little bit about my own life and my own struggle with this. This has been by far the greatest blessing in my life. And I believe as you go through the Old and the New Testament, it is simply the greatest truth in the entire Bible. I did one series one time entitled The Bible's Best Kept Secret, and that's another way to put this. I believe this is the Bible's best kept secret. Tom, if you could do me a favor, these are humming real bad. If you could just turn them off, unplug them, do whatever. Depower them. First thing I want to do this morning is I want to give you some definitions of shame so we all understand we're on the same page, all right? This is a Webster's dictionary, and you can look up in any other dictionary you might, and you might find just a little different definition, but I want to make sure we all understand what I'm talking about this morning. Shame, a painful emotion caused by consciousness of guilt and shortcoming. Ashamed, feeling shame, guilt, or disgrace, feeling inferior or unworthy. Sound familiar? It sounds familiar to me. And whether you want to acknowledge it or not, again, like I said, in the last 10 years, I have dealt with by now thousands of people who struggle with this area. Whether in their religious experience they have come to know Christ yet, or whether in their religious experience they know Christ. This just seems to be something that they struggle with day in and day out. I was doing yesterday at the at the women's all-day conference, they asked me to speak there, and a number of ladies come up to me and tell me this is one of the greatest struggles they have in their life. They just feel like I'm failing all the time. I feel like I'm failing all the time. That's shame. That shame. We want to try to do the right thing, and then all we feel like is we've fallen on our face, and we feel shame, we feel inferior, we feel unworthy. And we're going to get to the reasons why we have shame this morning. Someone's asked me when I was thinking of starting this series, they asked me, you know, Mark, is shame ever good? Is there such a thing as good shame? So I want to clear this up right away. Yes, there is. Yes, there is. That's not going to be my primary focus these 3 weeks, but there is, and let me explain so you don't misunderstand what I mean. We would want the Ku Klux Klan to be ashamed of their prejudice. Would you not? Of course you would. You'd want them to feel that's wrong. You would want their conscience to bother them. We would all want the molester to see his deeds as shameful. We would want the harasser to see their actions as shameful and inappropriate. See, shame, though, is not a politically correct word. Okay? Let me tell you what is inappropriate behavior. That's inappropriate. We have substituted it for shameful behavior, and this is how I mean shame has a good side to it. All right? Shame has a good side to it. I read an editorial in the USA Today not too long ago. I was really surprised to find it in there because it's one of the most liberal papers in the country, but I read it almost every day just to find out what people are thinking and what's going on. And one of the articles, I think it was written by a woman named Linda Chavez, was entitled, "What Happened to Good Old-Fashioned Shame?" Whatever happened to good old-fashioned shame? She went on to describe what it was like to grow up in the 50s and the early 60s and how shame was intended, okay, the good side of shame, when it bothers our conscience, was intended to be like an invisible electric fence that gave us boundaries, that made us realize, oh, I don't want to get pregnant without being married. That's exactly, in fact, what she was talking about in her article. In the 50s and the 60s, there was very little out-of-wedlock pregnancy. Today, no one sees it as anything inappropriate. Let me tell you what people do so you understand how this affects society. Now, when I comment on this, I want you to know that I have no personal vendetta here at all. In fact, I think this is kind of I think this just shows the silliness of Americans. But we have made smokers to feel like they are the dirge of the earth. I mean, they are relegated. Get outside 100 yards away from here, out there under that stupid tree, and, well, the dead tree, because we don't want you to kill the live one. And you know what? You know what? It's worked. The tobacco companies are really hurting today. And all of a sudden, we're going after them like they're the worst possible people, you know, in the whole world. Well, I think there's worse. I think it's a lot worse, quite frankly. And smoking, quite frankly, doesn't bother me. If someone wants to do that to me, that's an issue of their choice. But I'm just using that as an illustration to show you how society tries to use shame. But what I want to talk to you about is the bad side of shame. All right? What I call the haunting side of shame or the abusive side of shame. That's the primary focus of the next 3 weeks because that's what I believe most of us deal with. I think most of us understand, you know, that we have a conscience and conscience was there, you know, to help give us guidance and good boundaries so we could experience the best possible freedom. But shame has been really abused. And I'm going to talk to you this morning about where shame comes from. First of all, I want you to understand God never intended for any of us to be haunted by shame the rest of our life. That was never God's intention. Now, some of you may think that's quite strange coming from a church. And I'll get to that a little later, and in the following weeks we'll cover that. But there's something very important I want all of us to recognize this morning. Every one of us in this room, every person outside of this room in the entire world, has either had shameful things done to them or have done shameful things themselves. And we have to all, let's just all put ourselves in the same boat. All right, myself included. We have all had shameful things done to us that were very hurtful. And we have all done shameful things ourselves, either in deeds or things towards other people that caused them to feel ashamed. We're all in the same boat. Sometimes, you know, we can go through life feeling we're the only victim. All of us in the world have been victims of other people shaming us or of circumstances that brought shame to us. And all of us have been victimizers. If we're honest, we've teased, we've used sarcasm, we've been insensitive, we did something that caused someone else to feel bad. I have. You know, I was the oldest brother of six kids. Maybe I don't need to say any more. I didn't ever beat my brothers and sisters up. That was inappropriate in our family. But I was a merciless tease. And crossed the boundary many times between just fun-loving humor and something that really hurt. And I regret it. And I've personally apologized to all my siblings because of it. Now I want to give you the five areas that I believe cause shame. Now when I say this again, I just want you to know, you know, I'm not the guru of shame, okay? I just want everyone to know that. I'm not trying to get you to believe, you know, Mark Darling knows everything there is to know on shame. I cannot possibly in 3 weeks, in three 30 to 40 minute sessions, adequately cover every single rabbit trail of this issue. My intention is to give you a real positive place to start and to give you some tools and some truth that will put you on the healthy road to overcoming the shame issues in your life. That I'm convinced will happen at the end of these three sessions. But I can't possibly cover every issue. And, you know, I'm sure someone else could come up with the 100 areas that cause shame. Someone else might come up, well, Mark, there's not five, there's really only two. I just thought that I would share with you five that as I thought about my life and I thought about the people that I've dealt with in the last 10 years, these are the five primary areas that I could isolate that cause shame in our life. All right, the first one. By the way, let me just comment on this too. Some of you go, darn, I wish the lights were up so I could write this down. We do this on purpose at Evergreen. We do this in the dark on purpose so people feel more comfortable and more anonymous. But I want you to know this. All these sessions are taped. And you're more than welcome to go out and you can either rent them from the tape library or you can buy them. You can pop them in as you drive to work. It's a great opportunity to develop your personal spiritual life when you're stuck in rush hour or you're just driving back and forth what is often mindless time back and forth to work, listen to SETIs or KDWB or anything else that frankly is entertaining but doesn't do a whole lot for you. So this is an opportunity if you want. They're taped. You can take them home, sit down with a pencil and paper. Okay, so I just didn't want you to be thinking to yourself, I wished I could write this down. I'm going to forget it. You just listen. I think you'll remember much of it, but you can get the tapes if you'd like. So the first area that causes major shame in our life is our own sin. Okay, our own sin, our own mistakes, our own misdeeds. Many times, shame or feelings of guilt are the result of things we have done, choices we have made that we realize later are wrong and wish we hadn't done them. Now, I think if we're all honest, every one of us in this room, there's things if we could, we go back in our life and undo. There is for me. There are things I look back in my life and I realize I knew I shouldn't have done it, but I crossed a line and I did it anyway. When you do that long enough, here's what happens to the conscience. The conscience becomes scarred and seared. And it becomes more and more unfeeling. That's why in our society today, we've crossed so many boundaries. We've crossed them so often, so regularly. Sin is so normal that it has simply perpetrated upon us greater victimization of other people because nobody has a conscience anymore. And you know, for many years, that's how I lived my life. Many of us know there's choices that we made in our life that have brought us much pain in our lives. They brought us much pain. I like what Billy Graham says in a little calendar someone gave me once of his. He said, sin always rewards those who use it in pain, sorrow, regret, and eventually death. And that's true. In the beginning, sin always feels really good. It's kind of mysterious. It's kind of exciting. It's kind of titillating. And you think, oh, this is really great. And then afterwards, maybe a day, maybe the next morning, maybe a few weeks later, maybe years later, it comes back and it haunts you. And it bothers you. And for many, it eats away at it. We're going to talk about that. How to get rid of that. And then there's a second area that causes shame in our life. And this tends to be the area that most of us focus on. And I understand why. I understand why. And that is other people. Other people. Much of the shame that many people feel in their life has been brought about by other people. The hurtful things that have been done to us or said to us by others. It could be friends, siblings, parents. It could have been hurtful teasing. Could have been molesting. It could have been shame-based discipline. The list goes on and on, doesn't it? And many of us, we remember it very well. You know what happens with regard to this, how we tend to respond? One, obviously we feel very hurt. And it makes us feel very inferior and often makes us feel very unlovable. It also breeds resentment and hatred. And I'll share with you some examples from my own life of how it affected me. I've not had the worst possible life you could imagine. I've not had the best possible life anyone could imagine. I'm very thankful for the life God gave me, and I understand now at 40 all the reasons, most of them, why God's allowed the things that He has in my life. But I'm going to give you some of the silly things that happened and some of the more serious things that happened in my life that created shame by other people. One was just having the name Darling. Now, when my father's fault, I had the name Darling, that was his name. But, when I was a kid, I went to about 5 different schools growing up. And, whenever you're the new kid in the school, you always had to introduce yourself. The name Darling is not a real fun name to grow up with, When I was little, I would have been given anything to have been called Jones or Smith, Just something, or Johnson, like you have up here. There's John, look in the phone book sometimes. There's just all kinds of you up there. You get all kinds of friends and relatives. But wherever I'd go, nobody heard the name Darling, and everybody made fun of it. Diaper Darling, oh my darling, oh my darling. And, I don't know why people think this about me. Maybe just because I'm passionate about what I communicate, but they tend to think Mark's just got a bulletproof shield, Just bullets bounce off the guy. And maybe they think I'm such an ultra type A personality, which I'm not nearly as most people think. But I'd say I am equally sanguine as I am melancholy. I'm not an ultra sanguine. An ultra sanguine is a person who simply thrives on people all the time. They just fill their world with people. They party all the time. I never went to a party in high school. Out of all the leads in the drama, I never went to one of the parties they threw for the drama people. I was a loner. I used to go to movies by myself, walk downtown, the little town in Iowa I lived in, and walk home after the second showing of the same movie at 2:00 in the morning. I never went with anybody. And my friends used to call me Moody Blues. Not because of the band, but because I was so up and down. And I've battled with that all my life. Up, down, up, down. And I'm trying to, go like this more instead of like this. When I was young, it was like this. And then after I came to the Lord, it was more like this. And as I've grown older, hopefully it's more like this, And I tend to be an introspective person, and I tend to be a sensitive person. And when I was little, I didn't like that because my mother, and I'll get to this a little bit later. My mother and father are two very distinct personalities. My father was Clint Eastwood personified. And I'll share with you some examples of this in a moment. And my mother, she's very tender-hearted. She'd cry at the drop of a hat. I got a mixture of both, and I wished I didn't. There are times I really wished I wasn't so tender. I wished that I didn't get emotional, and that's been hard. Just dealing with that as a man,
feeling like, well, I'm kind of half and half. I don't like this. So, you know, that was mild, but it got old. It got old, you know. And then when I was in seventh grade, there were two incidents, two things that happened. One mild, one was pretty bad. The more mild one was, I played the trumpet. I didn't want to play the trumpet. But my mother, she didn't think, and I love her, by the way. You all know how much I love my mother. If you've been here before, she's just the jewel in my life, one of them. But my mother did not think God could use the drums, so she wouldn't let me play the drums. I always wanted to play the drums. My mother wanted me to play the trumpet. I hate the trumpet. And so anyway, I tried to play the trumpet. And so when I was in seventh grade, they needed trumpet players in the high school band, so they put me up in the high school band. And there was this guy who sat next to me, big guy. You know, I was a little guy then. When I graduated high school, I was only 130 pounds. And when I was in seventh grade, I think I was just breaking 100. And he was big. He probably weighed twice as much as I did. He was a big guy. And it was pretty intimidating for me, seventh grade, to be up there with these high school marching band. And I'd be sitting there playing my trumpet, trying to play my part, and he'd come down with his hand, slap me on the leg, you know, really hard on the thigh. And he'd do this every day. And I used to dream, tell you my dreams, I used to dream about walking along beside him with my trumpet case. And I'm just kind of talking to him. I'm kind of sucking him into my web. And the next thing, because this is how my father would act, see, and I'll get to that in a minute. And I'd be walking along, and I'd take the trumpet case, and I'd ram it into his belly. Well, aim a little lower, actually, is what I thought about. And then I'd take the trumpet case right up under his chin. Wham! And then I'd just leave him, you know, right there on the ground. Don't ever hit me again. But I never did. In fact, I only got in one fight in my whole life, actually. But then also in my seventh grade year, I played football. It was the first time I got to play organized football. And I counted the days when you could play organized football. You know, I love football. And so I had a good friend. His name was Mickey Grimmer. It was Mickey and there was me. And he was a quarterback and I was a halfback. And I'm not saying this to boast. It just is to help you understand the story and what happened. But we got to start over a lot of the other eighth graders and they were pretty upset. It was a little small school. And so, you know, we were pretty good for that little small school. Some of the guys, they really resented it. It bothered them. So one day, this was a few weeks after, we were down on the track. It was during school. Gym was going on. The girls were at the other end. We were down at our end. Mick and I had just run around the track, and we were also going out for track. So we were practicing the high bar where you jump over and you come down on that foam mat. Next thing I know, there are seven or eight of these eighth graders. And there were a few of them, they were much bigger than eighth graders and much bigger than I, extremely mean. I went to this school that was extremely mean-spirited. And they got me and Mick down and they took our shorts. First thing, they just took our shorts. And then they tied me up in my jock, and then they took my friend's jock, and I won't get into what they tried to force him to do. But I've never forgotten it. And it really bothered me for a long time. But there was a couple reasons it bothered me. One, it bothered me because it was so humiliating. But two, it bothered me because I knew if I was my dad, I would have busted their heads wide open to try to protect my friend. And I always felt like I was a coward. I never told him about it. No, it wasn't his fault. You have to understand, my father was grew up in just after the Depression, well, during the Depression. His father died when he was six. And just to tell you a little bit about what my dad was like, my father, number one, was a boxer, was literally a boxer. He was the kind of dad. Now, maybe this isn't true for every guy, but for me, he's the kind of dad you wanted to have. My father was like my hero. He was, in my view, Clint Eastwood and John Wayne all rolled up in one. This guy was tough, but he was very affirming. I had a very affirming dad. My dad had 132 fights. And he won 122 of them, and most of them were by knocking people out. My father grew up very rough in a very rough family situation. But when his father died when he was six, he left the family with nothing. There was nothing left for the family. So my dad has a twin brother. And just to give you an idea of what he grew up like, what he was like. When he and Kelly were about 11, it was Myra and Byron. They used to call them Connie and Kelly. I don't know how they got those names. I never have understood that story. Okay? All I know is nobody made fun of their name, Darling. That's all I know. And they went to the circus one time because they had this thing at the circus. They had this wrestler. He's a big guy, and if you beat him, you got $50. So Byron and Myron, they went up to him, and my dad's Myron, and said, we want to fight this guy. He said, look, we're not going to let two kids try to fight this guy. So they conned the guy into letting him fight. And, you know, the guy thought it was a joke, but he thought it'd be kind of fun. So he gathered all these people around. So my dad starts to taunt him, call him names, you know, and got him really mad. So just as he was getting really mad, my dad leapt at him, you know, jumped at him. He backed up to grab him. Kelly, in the meantime, was behind him. He forgot there was a twin in there and fell over him. And they got him down. They grabbed his finger and they bent it. And both of them. And they wouldn't let go because he wouldn't say uncle, so they broke it. When my father was 16, my father worked on the railroad. He lied about his age because of nothing else to do. And so he worked with a whole lot of different individuals. And the foreman told him, they said, now, Myron, you know, you're kind of the pretty boy here, and these guys don't like you. And I've got to leave today. This is the first time the foreman had ever left. Some very rough individuals he worked with. He said, now, I want to tell you something. These guys, some of them want to kill you. Just because they're jealous of your talent, they're jealous of you. If any of them bother you, I want you to take this pick handle, I want you to break it over their head. So my dad said, fine. So the guy left. And about 10 minutes after he leaves, about 15 of them gather around. And one of these big guys, you know, he really, really hated my dad. And my dad just picked it up, broke it over his head, split it right over his head. Laid the guy out just like that. That's the kind of dad I had. I wasn't afraid to go anywhere as long as my dad was around. But you know, I was never, I got my mom's soft side, and I was never, never quite like my dad. And you know, if it really wasn't that he made me feel ashamed, I just knew that, you know, my dad, if I had told him it happened, he said, son, you got to stand up to these guys, you tear into them, man, you got to let them know who's boss. That's what he'd say, you know. So I just never told him it happened. I realize some of you here have had far more hurtful things done to you than I have ever dreamed of having. I just want you to know I understand a little bit what it's like to be really humiliated and to kind of carry something with you, you know, that you just can't magically erase. But you know, God's helped me, and I'm going to share this with you later in the weeks, to forgive, and I don't bear any grudges. I really don't. I don't look back on it and think, you know, I wish I could go back and lay the guy out cold. What I really wish is I could go back and tell him what I found today. That's what I really wish. Now, you may not be at that point today, and I don't want you to feel bad because you're not, but I believe by the time we get done with this series, it will really help you along the way deal with some of the hurt and the resentment maybe and the anger and the frustration and the humiliation and maybe even the hate that you feel. The third thing that causes shame in our life is bad religion. There are many of you that maybe some of you got the flyer in the mail and you're thinking, what is a church doing talking about overcoming shame? That's the worst place in the world for shame. I mean, that's all religion does is shame you. And that's what many people's experience has been like. Many people's experience. You know, my father, when he grew up, went to a particularly religious school. And he said, I'm not going to tell you the name, and because I think there's also some real benefits from this particular denomination. But went to this school, and boy, I tell you, it was rough, and you got called up real regularly and got your hand beat on with a ruler for the silliest infractions, really. But there was just so much, and I've had many who have come here from that particular religious persuasion that have said, Mark, I've just felt so much guilt and shame all my life. Well, religion has played a big part in that. Particular religion that's always demanding that we do certain things that over and over again, if we do them, it will hopefully assure us our place in heaven and hopefully in the good favor of God. And so there's a lot of people who feel like it's God. See, when an authority figure in your life, particularly someone religious,
Because that tends to be someone we really think, wow, you know, they're like this with God. So when they say something over and over, or when they misrepresent God, we interpret that it's God. And so we spend our life thinking, you know, God's just down on me all the time. And then the fourth thing that causes shame in our life is our own thoughts. Our own thoughts, feeding on critical and damaging thoughts, replaying failure over and over in our mind. We view ourselves as damaged goods, and we shame ourselves. You ever thought about that? We shame ourselves. We just keep playing it over and over. The if-only syndrome. If only I were this. If only I had done that. If only I was better. If only. And we just play it over and over. And so it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy in our life. Instead of leaving the shame behind, we feed on it. It becomes almost an emotional cancerous growth on our soul, and it starts choking the life right out of us. And then there's the fifth thing, number five. And then I call this the world and the devil. Have you ever noticed that once you've failed in the eyes of the world, you are branded a druggie, a loser, a drunk, a thief, a slut, somehow unworthy of love, inferior to other human beings, and certainly unworthy of God's love and attention? Let me give you an example. I read a story, but some of you may have heard this. This is about 2 or 3 years ago. There was a young man, college basketball prospect, probably the best in the country at that time. He was in his senior at high school. And he did a really stupid thing, a really mean thing, a very awful thing. I'd never justify in any way, shape, or form what he did to another person. It was a stupid mistake. And he should have been very ashamed. It was a shameful thing. Well, he went to court and had worked to make restitution and made a public apology. Of course, there are certain things, you know, you never undo once they're done. Every college that was courting him dropped their scholarships, just like that. They dropped them all. And I just read recently a story. It was in the paper about 2 weeks ago of this same young man, because I remembered his name. I remember the scenario. It's been about 2 or 3 years later. And he's playing now at this junior college, and he's working to get his life back together and go in a positive direction of his life, except that, and the coach was sharing this, that when he shows up at games, regularly in the crowd, there's all these people with signs taunting just this one young man. It's very hard, isn't it, to overcome making a real mistake in our society. They don't let you. If you want to find out what I mean, you talk to someone who's been in jail before, who supposedly, you know, paid their debt to society. Society never lets you out of it. In their mind, you're always an ex-con. Well, let me tell you who's worse than society, the devil. And he's very real, and he will always throw up in your face your failure. He will remind you of it. He will try to debilitate you with it. He will paralyze you with it over and over and over again. Now, these are the five main causes of shame. And if we don't, at least it's my opinion, there may be more. But they were five that I could isolate. And if we don't learn to overcome them, we're just going to continue a cycle of discouragement, of frustration. You know, this particular issue leads to all kinds of other symptoms. It can lead to loneliness. It can lead to depression. It can lead to overeating. It can lead to all kinds of other habits in our life that we use to try to numb the pain of shame. This is kind of a silly thing, but whenever I think of shame, I think of Gomer Pyle. Shame, 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 you know. Old Gomer, that was his favorite phrase, you know. Of course, old Vince Carter, he had some things he ought to be ashamed of, you know. He was a pretty low life sometimes. But shame really is not funny. And what I want to do this morning in closing the service, I just want to share with you what has been the greatest crisis for me with shame in my life, and far greater than the other two examples that I gave to you. I've been married almost 18 years this May. May 5th, I'll be 18. Mostly wonderful, fantastic years. And I don't regret at all the girl that God gave me to marry. She's been the best thing that has ever happened to me except for the Lord. But
There were a lot of things I did as a young man that I really didn't realize would come back to haunt me. Seeds that I sowed, my own sin. One of them was my temper. My temper. I had a very bad temper. And as a young person, it was very out of control. So when I got married, I was 23 years old. And I look back, and I guess you could say I was extremely immature. That's an understatement. I was at least that. And I was madly in love. And I just thought, you know, heaven on earth had just happened. And now it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful experience. And I had only known the Lord a couple years in my life. And there were still a lot of things that needed to change in my life. But to be real honest, I thought most of the hard things were behind me. Well, little did I realize that most of the hard things were ahead of me. Marriage brought out the worst in my flesh. The worst. It brought out the worst impatience that I've ever displayed in my life, the worst fits of anger and rage. And I want to share something with you this morning. I'm not sharing this with you this morning because I'm proud of it. I'm not proud of it. I just want you to understand that I do understand the struggle of personal shame. For me, one of the things that made it even more difficult was that I had married Kathy under the premise that I wanted to become a pastor. She knew that. She knew that. That's all I wanted for the last 21 years. It's what I believe God wanted me to be. Well, what happened was about 3 weeks after we were married, my wife conceived. Now, first of all, no one informed me what it would be like to live with a pregnant wife. Now, I want to explain what I mean by that, okay? I don't mean this was her fault. I mean I was your average 23-year-old looking forward to a very passionate marriage. And boy, was I ever wrong. The next 9 months were anything but passion-filled. There was hardly any passion at all, and it about drove me out of my mind. And the reason about it drove me out of my mind is because of the fleshly things I sowed as a teenager. I'm not going to get into them. I'm not proud of them at all. They almost ruined my life. And my temper almost ruined my marriage. The things that I said, the things that I did, my behavior was way, way, way out of line. And quite frankly, it in my mind is a miracle that Kathy stayed with me. On top of that, we were going through unbelievable, difficult financial hard times. The first 7 years of marriage, we had no insurance of any kind, no insurance on any of our children, the first three that were born. The first couple, 3 or 4 years they were married, I made about $5,000 a year. That was it. And so there was unbelievable pressure in the financial front, and I felt unbelievable pressure in my own growing up. See, I knew that I've got to change if I'm going to become something God can use, and I don't know how. And I keep falling in this, and I keep falling on my face, and I'd feel so awful. I can't even begin to describe to you the hours that I spent walking the railroad tracks because they were the only place I could find alone, and bawling because of the shameful way that I had responded. And I did not know how to change. And I wanted it. I wanted it really bad. There were times as a young man I'd have given anything to have been a different person than I was. Times I wished I just asked God, just kill me, just take me home, or just zap me and please make me someone else. Because I hate who I am. Well, this struggle went on, particularly difficult for the first 3 years of our marriage. You know, it would ebb and flow. It would get bad, and then it would get good, and it would get bad, and it would get okay. In the meantime, I made an album. And then shortly after I made an album with the church I was working with, I wasn't a leader. I wasn't like a pastor of the church, but I helped lead the music and do other things in the church. I didn't do it for pay. I just did it voluntarily. And everyone knew me, and you know, I had basically a fairly good reputation. And to be honest, apart from this few couple areas in our marriage We really loved each other. But I felt so hypocritical. And finally, it just came to a head. And I realized I can't go on this way anymore. I can't go on this way. And so a guy that I knew in the church, he confronted me one day. He said, "Mark, we need to talk." I said, "Okay." He said, "I don't know what it is, Mark, but," he says, "something seems not to be right here." And it's the first time I ever opened up with anybody. It wasn't a very pleasant experience. I don't look back on it, frankly, with fond memories at all. I never felt the person was very compassionate. I never felt the person was very understanding. They were just very boom to the point. But I just told him, I said, "You know what?" I said, "I really think I need to step out of this leadership stuff. And there's just some needs in my own life. And I know I'm at a point in my life that I don't have my wife's respect. And I know that that I'm living here is really hypocritical. It's really a double standard. It's not right." So everybody found out about it. They didn't find out the whys. They just, you know, it was announced, "Mark, one of the reasons you won't see him here for a while is because Mark's, you know, got a lot of needs in his own life." And I felt so humiliated. For the next 6 months, literally, I've never been more discouraged and downtrodden in my entire life. I don't think I even smiled for 6 months. I was working then about 70 hours a week, and I worked days at an auto parts store in this route, and then partly in the store, and then in the evenings I worked at a video arcade babysitting college students, basically, and giving them change for their tokens, and just staring out in space wondering, what am I going to do now? And I came to the point, if you've ever felt like you've been attacked and you've just been destroyed from the inside out, I get to the point I just feel like I can never be a pastor. There's nothing. I'm cursed. I'm convinced I am totally unlovable, totally unusable, totally unworthy. Why in the world would God even want to give me the time of day? Because I'm such a jerk. Well, something happened, and I'm going to share that with you in the weeks to come. The truth that happened in my life that changed me forever. It changed me like no other period in my life. I just want to give you a little synopsis of what that is, and then I will develop it in the weeks to come. What happened was, someone gave me a tape. I had a friend come up to this video arcade one night, and he was a young man that my wife and I had led to Christ when we were cooks in a sorority, the first year we were married. And he was one of the waiters, and he came up to me, and I was the kind of guy who could, even though I was very discouraged inside, I really didn't want everyone to know that. So he came up, and I kind of put on a good show, and he said, "You know, Mark, I just feel like giving up. I just don't feel like going on anymore." And I said, "Well, you know, you really ought to read this book." I was into giving advice, you know. So I said, "You really ought to read this book." So he got this book, and he came back about 3 weeks later, and he said, "I've read it 4 times. It's the most amazing thing I've ever read." Well, I'd never even read the book. I just heard about it. You know? So I thought to myself, well, maybe I ought to read the book. The book's no longer in print. I've tried to get it to give it to the people. It's gone. It's just gone. And then I said, "Well, there's this other tape. You ought to hear this tape." And so he got it. He just started listening to it every day. I'd never listened to it. I just heard it was a good tape. So what happened was, I thought, you know, maybe I ought to listen to it. And I did. And I can't even begin to tell you what happened, you know, describe what I felt inside, but I just sat there listening, crying. Because I realized for the first time in my life, there was nothing that I've done that God can't love me through. That to God, I am never unlovable. Now I'm going to tell you my plan later on, what steps I took, and I don't want to get way ahead of myself. It's always hard for me to break these up into 3 weeks. That's the biggest challenge I face. Every time I do a series, is how not to just give it to you all at once. But here's what I discovered. I discovered God in a way that I never understood Him before. God's desire is not to mercilessly shame us, but to respond with love and forgiveness to us in spite of the shameful things we may have done, to make us new and whole, treating us with the same specialness He treats His own Son, Jesus. God's desire is to elevate us so that in His eyes we're as valuable as His Son. Understanding God's love broke the back of shame in my life. Christianity is not what most people think. It's not a place for more shame. It's the place to get rid of shame. Shame is never what Christ was about. Forgiveness, restoration, extraordinary kindness. That is what Christ was all about. Now, I want to give you an example. There are four, and I don't have time to give you all four. If you're not familiar with the Bible, I wish I could go into greater detail because I realize many of you aren't familiar with the stories of Jesus and his interaction with people. But I want to give you one or two of the stories of Jesus. One of them was with this woman that the Pharisees, they were the religious leaders of the time. And they're like many religious leaders of the day, always pointing the finger at everybody. They brought to Jesus, was in this crowd one day, and they brought this woman, who I believe probably was completely without clothes. And they threw her in front of the Lord, probably threw her down, and said, "Lord, this woman was caught in the very act of adultery, and the law says she should die." Now, to be caught in the very act of adultery, usually you don't have any clothes on. That's why I surmise that she probably didn't have any on. They did everything they possibly could to humiliate her and shame her. Jesus, here's the interesting story. Jesus, it says, began to draw in the ground. It says that. It's the only place it says that. He began to draw in the sand. Now, a lot of scholars, they have surmised that possibly Jesus was writing the names of the Pharisees who had slept with her. No way to prove that. I have my own theory. I believe Jesus was doodling on the ground because he didn't want to humiliate her by looking up while she was trying to get her clothes on. It's my opinion. So the Pharisees, you know, they're convinced we've caught Jesus. He's dead now. If he doesn't do what the law says, we know he's not from God. So Jesus looks up, probably just as she was done getting some robe on, and he says, "Whoever is without sin among you, you throw the first stone." Now, in the literal translation of what it means is whoever hasn't done the same thing yourself, been an adulterer or thought it, because Jesus told the Pharisees, if you've lusted for a woman in your own mind, you're guilty of adultery. So he changed the rules. See, he really blew their mind. He said, "Why don't you throw the first stone?" And the Bible says they started leaving one by one, the oldest to the youngest. Why would it be the oldest to the youngest? The older you get, the more lust has happened in your life. That's why. And they walked away. And finally, there was no one left but this woman. And Jesus said, "Woman, where are your accusers?" Now imagine, this woman's really guilty. She really did what they said she did. She never denied that she did it. This wasn't like a false charge. She really did it. And she's standing not in front of Jesus. She's standing in front of God. Jesus was God. This has got to be the most unbelievable experience in a person's life. And then he says, "Well, woman, where are your accusers?" "They've all gone, my Lord." And Jesus said, "I don't condemn you either." Can you imagine hearing that from God when you know that you're guilty of what you've just been accused of? And then he said, "Look, you leave this life. It's only been hurting you. You don't have to live this way anymore. Leave your life of sin. Go and do something different with your life." He restored dignity to her that she'd never had. You remember the story of Zacchaeus? Some of you may remember the little song when you were in Sunday school. Zacchaeus was a tax collector, which is basically a Jewish individual who was helping the Romans rob from Jewish people. That's how tax collectors made their money. They collected the Romans' taxes, and then any they could skim extra. Then they paid the Romans their cut and kept whatever they could get. And Jesus is walking one day, and he sees this short little guy because he climbed up in a tree because he couldn't see the Lord. Now, Jesus is a person who reads people's body language, see, which you can learn to do. It gets pretty easy after a while as you grow in your discernment. And he realized, this guy really wants to see me. That was pretty obvious, wasn't it? He's obviously a short guy. I think I'll make his stay. Said, "Hey, Zacchaeus, how about I go to your house and have dinner today? Can we have dinner together?" "Wow, the Lord, this mighty miracle worker is coming to my house." And Zacchaeus gets down, runs on up ahead, and he has this big feast, massive feast, and all of his cronies are around, and they aren't the best people in the world. I just want you to know that. Because the Pharisees, they're standing outside going, who is this eating with these tax collectors and sinners? Because, see, they wouldn't have anything to do with these people. Zacchaeus, he stands up in the middle and he goes, Lord, if I have robbed anyone, I will pay them back seven times. And from now on, he went on, you know, I'll collect only what I'm supposed to collect. That was a miracle. And then the Lord said, today salvation has come to this house. So you can tell when salvation comes because people's lives start to change. The Lord didn't look up at Zacchaeus and say, you little scumbag, get down out of the tree. You ought to be ashamed of yourself selling out our people. That's how we think of God. That's exactly how we think of God, and I hope to shatter your stereotype of God in the next 2 weeks. And I believe in so doing and helping you understand what God's really like and what He's really done for you and what you can really have in this thing called Christianity, it will begin a revolution in your life. I want to invite you back next week because what I'm going to talk about is getting rid of the scarlet letter in your life. And all of us feel there's particular areas, maybe one, two, or three, we feel they just hang around our neck. They're there all the time. We feel like it's our scarlet letter. And we're going to talk about how to get rid of that in your life. I want to invite you back. Bring your friends out. We get them sitting in the aisles because I believe that most of the people you know struggle with this area. Let's pray. Lord, we want to thank you this morning for your mercy and your love in our lives, for your faithfulness. Lord, I just am overwhelmed by your loving kindness towards me. What I've experienced in the 21 years of my life of knowing you, all I can say, Lord, is whoever's been forgiven much loves much. And the only way I can explain my love for you is by helping people understand how much you've forgiven me of. I just ask you, Lord, that you'd touch our lives, that you'd help us realize, give us hope, a ray of hope that we can overcome these issues of our life. It's one of the primary reasons you came was to set us free from our bondage to shame. You give these folks a good week, Lord. Bring us back next week safe and ready to learn in Jesus' name. Amen.